the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jimma Gaudette. It is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Ian Max Stevenson, who covers state politics and climate change at the Idaho Statesman, and Alex Breezy, who covers breaking news and crime for the Idaho Statesman. Hey, happy Friday to both of you.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Okay, so while Donald Trump was convicted yesterday in New York, another trial came to a conclusion as well. This time in Idaho, Chad Daybell was found guilty of first-degree murder, I think three counts, for killing his wife, Tammy Daybell, and his next wife's two children, 7-year-old J.J. Vallow and 16-year-old Tylee Ryan. Alex, before we get to yesterday's verdict in that case, give us a little synopsis and background of everything that's brought us to this point, because this case has been going on for years, and it's finally coming to a conclusion.
Yeah, Sam. So like you said, yeah, this case has been going on for a really long time. I was actually in college when all this first started, so it's been going on for such a long time. It kind of started back in 2019 when the two children, JJ and Tylee, went missing, and extended family and family out of the state couldn't find them, didn't hear from them, started getting worried, contacted police. Police started looking for them. They couldn't get a hold of Lori, who is their mother, Lori Vallow Daybell. And they eventually did find her, and, you know, they just weren't getting straight answers on where the kids were. Fast forward about 9 months, and they end up finding the two children's remains buried on Chad Daybell's property. And Lori and Chad had been having an affair kind of the year before that, and had gotten married kind of during this time period where the kids went missing and they got married. And then as you said earlier, his first wife, Tammy Daybell, mm-hmm. also died during all this. So it kind of left this, you know, string of deaths. And it was just this, you know, kind of case that garnered a lot of national attention.
It really did. And it was, you know, there was a hunt for the kids, and mm-hmm. it has just been going on and on. And so you mentioned Tylee and JJ's mom, Lori Vallow Daybell. She's already been convicted. So Chad was on trial. What happened in court yesterday?
Yeah, so this is kind of the conclusion of about, or close to the conclusion of about 2 months of testimony and witnesses being called. And so yesterday was actually quite a short day. The jury was still deliberating in the morning, and at around, I believe, maybe one-ish, early in the afternoon, the jury came back and decided that they were ready to give their verdict. And at 2, they came in to give their verdict. And they found Chad guilty on all of the 8 counts against him, which would include those 3 first-degree murder charges for Tammy, JJ, and Tylee, along with conspiracy to commit murder. And then he also had 2 charges for insurance fraud because he had raised Tammy's life insurance policy. And, you know, with the conspiracy charges, that's obviously, you know, wasn't allowed. It was a crime. So.
Sure. How long did the jury deliberate? They weren't out very long.
No, they weren't. It was about 6 hours, which was just about an hour shorter than they did in Lori Vallow's case. They took about 7 hours in her case. So it's about on par with what we've seen for those two cases, but obviously not a very long deliberation.
And how did Chad Daybell react yesterday in court?
You know, he didn't have much of a reaction. He was pretty emotionless. I don't think, has been very overly reactive throughout the trial in general. I've seen him shake his head on a couple occasions, but yesterday was, you know, pretty much just kind of stood there silently as the verdicts were read in.
And you had a really good, cohesive story, a lot of info yesterday. What did you hear from family members of the Vallow children? How do they feel about the verdict?
Yeah, so JJ's grandfather, Larry, and his wife, Kay Woodcock, they have been really outspoken and have really been advocating for the kids since they first went missing. They're actually the ones that kind of pointed out that they hadn't been speaking with their grandchild. And Larry was at the courthouse, and he spoke to reporters after the verdict was read. And, you know, he talked about how they're so glad that this is coming to an end, and that no matter what kind of comes next in the death penalty portion of this case, they're going to be happy to, you know, kind of get this past them. And that, you know, they also just talked a lot about how, as much as obviously this is a really terrible thing that they've had to go through for so long, that Daybells can't take away the memories that they had with their grandchild and their family.
Yeah. And they've just been through the ringer with everything that's happened. You mentioned the death penalty.
Yeah.
What happens now? Chad has to be sentenced, and there's some debate over whether he could get the death penalty. Yes.
Yeah. So he is eligible to get the death penalty, but it's really up to those same jurors that brought in the verdict yesterday will now decide on the death penalty. So they're currently in court right now, listening to some more testimony. It sounds like they did opening kind of statements again, like how they do it kind of at the beginning of a trial. And then there's an opportunity to present evidence, and that actually portion was skipped over. So they're going straight into victim statements. And so several people that knew Tammy, JJ, Tylee, family, friends are testifying and kind of just telling people a little bit about who they were. And then I think there might be one other portion after that, and then the jury could start begin deliberations, and they'll decide whether or not to sentence him to death.
Today's got to be tough with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Okay, well, I know you're going to keep following it. Appreciate the update, and we'll see
of course
what happens in sentencing. Ian, let's get back to that other trial yesterday. Donald Trump convicted in New York. And after the news came out, we heard from some Idaho politicians who are still supporting Trump despite the conviction. What did you find out?
Yes. So yesterday, Donald Trump became the first president in history to ever be convicted of a crime. Manhattan jury found him guilty on all 34 counts in a case about Trump's payoff payment to a porn star to keep their alleged affair from becoming public during the 2016 presidential campaign. And almost immediately after the jury's verdict was read, Idaho Republicans came to Trump's defense, joining what seems to be kind of the standard GOP response to this case, which is that it was saying it was politically motivated and illegitimate. So Governor Brad Little suggested the verdict doesn't matter in a social media post, and that the only election, or it's the only verdict, as he said, that matters is the November election. Representative Mike Simpson and Senators Jim Risch and Mike Crapo called it a political trial, and Simpson attacked the district attorney in New York who led the case. I also saw a reaction from some politicians that this case was somehow organized by President Joe Biden, which is false. There's no evidence of that. This is a case in state court in New York that began years before Biden entered office and was prosecuted by a local elected district attorney there. But some far right legislators in Idaho, members of the Idaho Freedom Caucus, made that claim in a news release today. There was a notably different response from Terry Pickens. She's a Boise lawyer running for governor as a Democrat in Idaho. She blasted Little for his comments about the verdict, saying that he had betrayed his oath of office to defend the rule of law. So those were some of the varied reactions we've seen in the hours since Trump's conviction yesterday afternoon.
Interesting. And you've got all those in your story at The Statesman, and folks can read that online. And Alex, let's talk about crime a little bit. A prisoner at the Pocatello Women's Correction Center is suing the Idaho Department of Correction, saying she was sexually assaulted by a correction officer while at the prison. And let's start with that accusation. What does she say happened?
Yeah, so she said there was a couple different instances, but in kind of the main instance, she said that he forced her to perform oral sex on her, on him. And overall, you know, just felt very threatened by their relationship because of the power dynamic between a correction officer and obviously a prisoner. And she just kind of felt like she had to do whatever was asked of her and had no ability really to say no.
And so she accused Derek Stetler of doing this. Did he admit to the crime?
He did. He did admit to the crime. This is kind of an older case that's kind of gotten new light because of the lawsuit. So when they were investigating the accusations against him, Idaho State Police did an outside investigation. And during an interview with state police, Settler did admit that he had, you know, had some kind of relationship assault with her, because he knew under the there's a Prison Rape Elimination Act, and under that act, correction officers cannot, prisoners cannot consent to any kind of like sexual act or anything that happens. So anything that would have happened between them would have been considered assault, and he knew that, and he admitted to it.
And that act, that's pretty important, because that it says the prisoners basically cannot consent because of, as you said, there's a power dynamic there.
Yeah, exactly. And it was it's a federal act that was enacted back in, I think, like the 2000s by President George Bush. And it does a variety of different things. There's reports that the state prison systems have to do because of it, and different various things. But that is, one of the, main things is that, there is no consent for a prisoner because of that power dynamic. Yeah.
And you wrote in the article about one of the big issues was a blind spot in the kitchen. What's that? And has it been fixed?
Yeah. So in most prisons, and also in our prisons here in Idaho, they have cameras all over the place to watch things, keep an eye on things. And there were several cameras in the kitchen area, which is where Settler worked. He was assigned as a food service officer. And this woman also worked in the kitchen. And in that area, there were a lot of blind spots with the cameras, so that, these incidents couldn't be seen. And he would actually tell her, only go into the blind spots and that kind of thing. And since this happened, about a year after it happened, in November of 2022, the prison did add cameras to the Women's Center, and also to actually another prison in the Boise area, to hopefully, fix that problem.
And what does the IDOC say about this case? What have they come out and said?
They didn't comment specifically on the case, especially with the pending lawsuit. And that's a pretty typical response. But they did overall say that, they don't, they're not okay with any kinds of sexual violence or anything like that. And, they talked a little bit about some of the additional steps they've taken, including adding guidance and resources for their officers and for the residents. And that, in any case like this, they will investigate it further and send it to state police, as they did in this case, to get that further criminal investigation if needed.
And there's a lot more to this case. It's all in the story. So check it out, Alex. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks.
Ian, this next story just won't go away. There's another chapter in the ITD headquarters story. And before we get into the latest news, take us back before this year's legislative session. That's when the state was planning to sell the Idaho Transportation Department campus and then go get a new one.
Right. So ITD's headquarters had been on State Street in Boise. The property was damaged in a flood 2 years ago and also had asbestos in the building. And after surveying their options, state officials, backed up by the legislature, decided to sell this property and move the headquarters to another location. So the legislature budgeted money to pay for this move and to start working on designs for the new location. And the state also moved ahead with its standard procedure for selling property. So this includes declaring the existing campus surplus property, putting it out to bid on the market, which they did, and some real estate developers put in the highest bid. And in late summer last year, the state announced that the property would be sold to those developers.
And then at this year's legislative session, lawmakers decided not to sell the campus. How did that unfold?
Right. So starting last fall, members of the budget committee started to get skeptical of the sale. They started to think that the cost of permanently relocating the headquarters was too high, and they were disappointed about the sale price. They thought they were going to get between $80 to $100 million initially, and the final sale price was about $52 million. So while a lot of lawmakers agreed with them, with that view, many didn't. To them, to cancel a sale that had already been agreed upon amounted to essentially the state reneging on its word. So there was also disagreement over whether the legislature could legally do this. The budget committee inserted language into sort of its standard government appropriations bills that would revoke these sales, which some lawmakers felt is not allowed. And this became a flashpoint during the session and ended up actually delaying its end by a few days. But eventually, a narrow majority of lawmakers voted to kill the sale.
And that, just to dive into the weeds for a minute, there's a rule in the legislature that a bill should be about one thing. And when you start tucking things into other bills, like a budget bill, then it gets murky. And I see where that could be a question. But the bill passed, right? So the bill passed. The sale was kiboshed. And then the companies that were supposed to buy the campus said, well, that's not right. And they sued the state. So Raul Labrador, that's Idaho's attorney general, was supposed to argue this case for the state. So what has happened now?
So as you said, the developers sued last month, and they're bringing the case to the Idaho Supreme Court and asking the court to allow the sale to go through. They're arguing, as you said, that the single subject rule in the Idaho Constitution was violated here by these two budget bills that included language revoking the sale. And so they want the court to overturn that. And the attorney general is the one who generally represents the state in lawsuits that are against the state or any of its various agencies. But in this case, almost immediately, it became clear that there was a rift between Governor Brad Little and Labrador about how to approach the case. Hmm. So Labrador filed initial arguments on behalf of the state, saying that the court can't force the state to sell the property if it no longer wants to. So essentially defending the legislature's move to revoke this sale. And Little's office and the governor, they pretty quickly said that the Labrador's arguments had not been approved by Governor Little and other state officials, which Labrador has denied. And things have basically only escalated from there. So Little moved to replace the attorney general's office with an outside lawyer to represent two of the state agencies that are named in this lawsuit. That's the Idaho Transportation Department, and another agency called the Department of Administration. And I think this kind of gets us to the essence of this dispute, which is that there's a disagreement over how to respond to the case. Labrador thinks that it's his job to defend the laws that the legislature passes, but Little didn't like how the legislature canceled the sale. He actually ended up not signing those two bills that revoked the sale and allowed them to become law without his signature, which is something that he very rarely does. He usually signs bills or on other rare occasions vetoes them. And his chosen attorney in this case, who replaced the AG's office for those two agencies, suggested in her filings this month that what the legislature did is unconstitutional because of this requirement that we talked about, that laws passed be about a single subject. And these budget bills they're the standard appropriations bills that the legislature passes each year for different agencies. So they have lots of money in them, allocated for various purposes. And there's essentially a single sentence or maybe a couple of sentences in those bills that also say, and we're revoking the sale of this property. And so then the news in the last couple of days is that the Idaho House has gotten involved in the case too. And attorneys for House Speaker Mike Moyle filed arguments this week and have made some pretty striking accusations about the executive branch and Governor Little. The House has accused the governor's administration of essentially colluding with these developers and of failing to defend the legislature's laws. They said, quote, "The House is disturbed by what appears to be attempts in the executive branch to deprive the state of a defense in this case." And so it's become quite a kind of divisive battle here between different parts of Idaho's government.
Wow. This just gets murkier and weirder as we go. We have three sets of lawyers now. The governor's lawyer, the AG's office. Now, Idaho House lawyers have weighed in with, as you said, saying that the governor was aligned with these companies trying to buy the campus. So who's going to fight the case in court?
That is a good Question. So the case is scheduled to be argued in August. And over the next few days, the attorneys involved will be telling the court how they plan to be involved in the argument. So they'll need to say whether they'll be there to speak and argue, or whether they'll be there but not presenting oral argument, or whether they'll be there but deferring to another lawyer to present their argument. And you're right, we've got four sets of attorneys here for the different parties. There's still the attorney general representing the state, but then there's this outside attorney representing the two agencies, ITD and the Department of Administration. And then there's, of course, the lawyers for the plaintiffs. And then there's now the lawyers for the Idaho House too. So in theory, I think we could hear from all of these, you know, some representative of all these sets of lawyers, but there's still 2 months left before these arguments. So I suspect we'll get a clearer picture of that in the coming weeks as more documents are filed.
So what did the governor's office say to some of these accusations that came from information from the House lawyers?
So these accusations from the House have come just in the last couple of days, and Little's office so far hasn't really responded to them directly. A spokesperson for his office told me yesterday that the state's executive agencies are seeking to ensure that the Idaho Constitution is followed, and that that's what they want the court to address. And in the filings so far that Little's chosen attorney for these two executive agencies have filed, she's argued essentially that the legislature's action this year puts these two agencies in a really tough spot, because there's a general law that says when property is declared surplus, here's what you have to do and here's how you dispose of the property. And that, and they say that they followed that process and put the property out to bid and negotiated with the highest bidder. And then now the legislature is kind of coming in at the 11th hour and working to undo that sale. And so that they have kind of conflicting mandates from these two things, and they need the court to help them figure out what they're supposed to do about them. But the little spokesperson yesterday told me that those agencies' legal arguments will be spelled out further when they're filed in court. And so I think we'll have to wait for those to come in to get a better picture of their perspective.
And as you said, we've got a couple of months before the next step in the case. And while all this is going on, this sort of interfighting in the Idaho government, the campus is in limbo, right? It's just, they can't really do anything with it right now.
Yeah, I mean, the employees of ITD have been operating out of a separate campus in Boise since the flood. And so there's a lot of, if they do end up retaining this property, there's a lot of renovation that's going to need to happen in the coming years to make it sort of suitable for use again. Depending on what happens in August before the Supreme Court and their eventual decision sometime after that, they'll likely give further direction on how the state proceeds with this property.
And believe it or not, there's actually more to this story. So look it up, and we'll put a link to it on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. And Ian, you seem to have all the complicated stories. Do you do any simple stories? The National Democratic Party is supporting a candidate in an Idaho legislative race. So who are they backing?
Yeah, so the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, which is a wing of the National Party involved in state-level races, is backing a candidate named Mary Shea for a District 29 House race. District 29 is over in eastern Idaho in Pocatello. And she is challenging Representative Dustin Manwaring, who's a Republican incumbent in the House who is currently the fourth highest ranking GOP member of the House. He serves as caucus chair for the GOP.
And why is the National Democratic Party interested in a House race in Idaho?
Yeah, so the DLCC, that group I mentioned, is an effort by the party to pick up seats for Democrats. I did some research, and since 2017, they've been spotlighting specific candidates around the country. which I think generally stems from the party's efforts to counteract the big gains that the GOP has made in legislatures across the nation. The GOP controls more legislatures than Democrats at the moment in the 50 states we have, and the Democratic Party wants to change that, of course. So while they focus some of their efforts on winning races in purple states where control of a legislative chamber hinges on just a couple of seats, they also look to pick up seats where they can, even in states like Idaho that have GOP supermajorities. And I think they took a look at the political landscape and saw an opportunity in Pocatello this fall. Of the three legislators from District 29 at the moment, two are already Democrats, which means that enough voters there, many of whom are unaffiliated with either party, are willing to vote for Democrats to win them seats. And I think the party is betting that some of the really divisive political and social issues that have been in the news recently, things like Idaho's abortion bans, the legal liability for libraries that was passed into law this year, school vouchers, are out of step with median voters, and that enough of those voters might be sufficiently turned off by the current GOP platform to cast their vote for a Democrat. And so I think the Democrats are looking at that district and wanting to make it a clean sweep for their party in the upcoming election in November.
Well, this is Eastern Idaho, Pocatello, as you said. And is it more Republican or Democrat? I think I saw in your article there are a lot more Republicans than Democrats. But as you said, there's some independents there.
Right. So the district includes most of the city of Pocatello. Mm-hmm. And a plurality of the voters there are registered Republicans, as you said, about 44%, according to data from the Secretary of State's office. And 15% of registered voters there are Democrats. But 39% are unaffiliated. So that indicates that more than a third of voters don't really have a strong loyalty to either party and might be making more, maybe candidate-specific or race-specific electoral choices when election season comes around.
So is this the start of a trend? You said this has been going on for a while now with this group. Are we going to see more national interest in these Idaho state races to try and turn some of that supermajority into, I guess, less of a supermajority?
I think that's a good question, and I think it depends a bit. Over the last few cycles, this DLCC Democratic group has backed two other Democrats, one being Senator James Ruckte, who happens to also be in District 29. He's the current senator in the same district that Shea is now running in against Dustin Manwaring. And a couple of years before that, the group backed another race in the Ketchum area. And they've been successful in the past in picking these races. And I think there's no doubt that the state party, so the Idaho Democratic Party, is trying to bolster their chances. They made a real effort this year to run more Democrats in districts in the state where in the past, sometimes Republicans have often won unopposed races and where there's not much competition in the November general elections against whoever the Republican candidate is running for that office. But I also think that the kind of political reality for Democrats in most of Idaho is still pretty stark. And I think the National Party probably knows that. For some context here, out of the 105 lawmakers at the Idaho Capitol at the moment, 18 of them are Democrats. So I think that for most of those races, the party is probably still concluding that their money is maybe better invested in races in other legislative districts in other states.
Well, and what about the race itself? What are Shea's chances in November? She almost beat Manwaring before, and I think I remember that he's lost to a Democrat before.
Yes, so he was first elected in 2016, I believe. And then lost a race against a Democrat in 2018. And then since then, turned that around and won in 2020 and then won again in the last cycle, excuse me, in 2022. So He's now a two-term incumbent and is looking to win again in November, of course. And I think that, you know, given the wins that Democrats, some other Democrats that I mentioned have had in her district, I think Shea definitely has a chance of winning in November. And I should point out that, you know, the significance of this backing from the National Party is perhaps going to be significant. The backing from the party will likely mean more money for her and her contest against Manwaring, because it'll kind of bring a national spotlight on this race, as well as a number of these other legislative races that the group is backing around the country. And it could bring, you know, donors, some donors from out of state, people looking to get Democrats elected to give money to her candidacy against Manwaring. And that could make a difference as these campaigns play out. She did face him in 2022. So this contest is a repeat of the election back then. And she lost by about 4.5%. So he did beat her by a fair amount in that race. But we'll have to see how the campaigns shake out over the next 5 months. I talked to Shay this week, and she talked about the importance of door knocking and talking to the candidates in her district. And I think kind of another interesting aspect of this is that the district boundaries, of course, were, after redistricting in 2020, the lines changed as they do every 10 years. And the District 29 used to include kind of a large swath of rural Bannock County to the south of Pocatello. And in the recent redistricting, that area is now in a different district. And so it's really just the area around Pocatello. And there's some precincts, I think, that have been added kind of in other parts of the city that weren't there before. And I think because of those changes, the campaigns are dealing with some new voters who are newly added to their district and maybe weren't totally sure how those precincts would pan out in the election. And now that we've got an election with those new boundaries kind of that already happened, I think the campaigns will have more data about, you know, where their base is, where their voters are, where perhaps they need to focus on convincing people to vote for them, and, you know, where some of those likely voters are. And so she thinks that she's kind of going to be able to narrow that margin through some of that work. And of course, Representative Manwaring is going to be campaigning too. And I know that he's pushing for kind of running. He told me he doesn't always affiliate with other Republican campaigns and tries to kind of be an independent candidate and run on advocating for small businesses and things like that. And so I think it'll be a really interesting race over the next 5 months, and we'll be tracking it to see how it pans out.
It'll be interesting to see, and we will continue to watch your coverage. Ian, thanks.
Thank you.
I want to thank our reporter roundtable today. Ian Max Stevenson covers state politics and climate change at the Idaho Statesman, and Alex Breezy, who covers breaking news and crime for the Idaho Statesman. Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.